The following podcast is not relating to my teachings and work at Del Cid Medical Center and is for entertainment purposes only.
Welcome, everybody. This is another episode of The Life of Flo, your favorite, most amazing podcast ever. We are today going to be discussing about the outpatient care model, what we believe is the good, the bad, the ugly, the threats currently to the model, and some... As per usual, some tangential conversations, probably specifically on goals of care, as there's seems to be a lot of scrutiny in many ways, shapes, or forms. And for that, we invited two friends of the pod that we respect and love collaborating with, and that is Fadi Saab, who is the Chief Operations Officer at Advanced Cardiac and Vascular Amputation Prevention Centers in the Grand Rapids, Michigan area, and Brett Weifman, who is the Medical Director at Vascular and Interventional Physicians in Gainesville, Florida. And I thought that was cool, and I hope that you enjoy it. And I think that this is a particular topic that we're going to have these guys over a couple of more times, because there's going to be a lot more here to dissect. This was just the tip of the iceberg in this.
Yeah, I think we talked a lot of pressing questions about the current states of general vascular care in general. So it was a good conversation.
All right, stick around. Buena vida.
Two vascular surgeons walk into a bar and come out with a podcast. We are talking everything vascular and not. Welcome to the Life of Flo podcast.
Are you avoiding showing your legs because of varicose veins? Worry no more. At Hope Vascular and Podiatry, we have the solution. Our vascular specialists are ready to rid you of those pesky varicose veins. Regain your confidence and enjoy life without complexes. Call 346-400-4673 or visit our website at www.hcic.io. Because at Hope Vascular and Podiatry, the new normal is you better.
This conversation, I think, is going to be really exciting. We always spitball a little bit before these things and try to come up with something that's enticing. And I think... having three people that are strong opinion leaders in this podcast that essentially have elected to do their service, their clinical service, their clinical duties in the outpatient care model, obviously allows for probably a really rich conversation. And Lucas, you come from an institutional side, so it's going to be interesting to add that perspective. But one of the things that I've come to realize in this kind of senior part of my career was how inappropriate the acute hospital setting was for the care of my patients with peripheral arterial disease, and probably more so with limb-threatening ischemia, given the long-term, meaning lifelong battle that this is. And so... having these episodic events of care mismatched from appropriate longitudinal care was the perfect recipe for just disaster. And so I felt that I would do these overly exuberant procedures with multiple accesses in either both hybrid or open or endo. And then that patient would have these beautiful pulse and then boom, disappeared. I had no idea what happened. I would never see Miss Smith again. And then I would get reconsulted for the other leg a few months, maybe a year or two later, and she had already an above-the-knee amputation, unbeknownst to me. And that was the common denominator of my days. It was these multiple battles with ED-based patients, people that would just roll in. But I would have very little grasp on where they would go and how I could care for them. And so it was a realization that outpatient models of care and a decentralized model of care probably is better, as is for many other disease conditions. And I think that, I always bring dialysis patients as an example, because, those patients are better served outside of the hospital, right? They don't come to the hospital for their dialysis. Their units are out there. They're there in and out a lot. it's they're going to have that probably all their life, unless they have a transplant, of course. But it didn't make much sense to me to continue fighting the fight from a place where I didn't think I was going to be really pushing the needle. And so when I elect to make this decision, then a lot of people say, you're crazy because the OBLs are going to disappear. That doesn't make any sense. And it, you know, it was calculated, and it was, you know, partly because I wanted to and partly because I had to. But it was in retrospect, and still today, and this has been now a couple of years out, it is the right thing. And I feel very, very strongly that this is the right thing. But the reality is that there is a threat. The model is a threat, not only a threat from professional judgment, but I think a threat from financial stability, as a lot of these codes, you know, kind of are just chipped away on a constant basis. And so I would like to, you know, Brett, you've been doing outpatient care for probably longer than any of us, and you've seen a lot of these changes. And so I'd like your opinion just on this kind of historic perspective of, you clearly saw the writing on the wall earlier than all of us, and you've been doing it. Yeah, you know, you even, I think, mentioned, you know, I come from the days where it was really, you know, a very nice model, and now we don't know. Right now, a lot of them are potentially even going to shut down. So maybe you can bring me up to speed as to your thoughts that you've seen this, and not only that, but then you're also the past president of the OEIS, which we have to absolutely get into here shortly, as I believe, you know, how do you defend models as you create entities that defend these models. But Brett, your thoughts on the history of these outpatient services and what's come to now become a threat, I think, in many ways.
Yeah, thank you for having me on and for asking about my opinion on things. We certainly have had a nice run of things since we opened our lab in 2006, which, and we have seen a lot of shift, largely related to reimbursement policies. And then there's the normal ebb and flow of your own practice. You know, maybe dialysis management becomes a larger part or a smaller part of your practice. Maybe venous access, you know, as an interventional radiologist, we offer a lot of services in our center. But what we have seen is as the reimbursement strategies change, we've been able to morph and still capture a reasonable amount of revenue to maintain our site of service. But as everything starts to get cut, then you can no longer morph and find that sweet spot. And that has been a, it's kind of a blessing and a curse to be diversified in your practice. You know how CMS works. When they see how much money they might be spending on a particular procedure or a particular area of medicine, if that number goes high, for whatever reason, more people get into it, then that's where they cut. We've seen it on the imaging side. We've seen it on the dialysis side in 2017 when there was about a 30% cut to dialysis access management across the board. So it's a challenge, no doubt. And you know where things go, as I mentioned before, when you get these continuous cuts that you just described, you don't know where to go. And so it becomes an existential threat, really. And the model of non-hospital site of service is threatened right now, in my opinion.
Fadi, you jumped earlier than me, and you've seen these cuts too. What are your perspectives here on where we're going, and how would you see that there's a defensible thought process, or you know, what things can we do? Because I think you're a firm believer that these models of care are probably better for your patients. Is that you would agree with me, I guess.
Yeah, you know, you know, we always get asked that question, all of us that are in this field. And, you know, I've always thought of myself as a geek, academician, you know, like liking research and interested in the field. And everybody asks, look, how did you decide to move to the outpatient lab? And I said, I made the decision when I felt that I could not be the clinician that I want to be within a hospital environment. And I want to be clear from the beginning. I'm sure there's great facilities that have a physician champions or champions in general that advocate for what we're trying to do. But for the lack of a better term, you know, all of us here agree that it's very difficult to create the appropriate environment to care for those patients within large institutions for a variety of reasons, you know, probably beyond the scope of what we're doing here. But, you know, when I saw that a major amputation is still accepted and in some cases encouraged under the umbrella of appropriate medical care as a first line of therapy to a lot of those patients with critical limb ischemia, you know, I struggled with that quite a bit. And it's still up to this day, as we're having conversation today, amputation or having a major amputation below the knee or above the knee, we all know, regardless of the discipline, regardless of your experience, it is still an accepted modality of treatment, first line of therapy for a lot of patients. And I'm not talking about amputation and sepsis or these appropriate clinical scenarios. We're talking in general. And the challenging part is when a lot of us CLI physicians who are, you know, there's an explosion of technology and techniques that you are able to salvage a lot of those patients successfully. But, you know, even though we're able to, you know, revascularize these patients have to have maintenance of perfusion. So what's happening in a lot of these institutions is there's weaponization of peer review processes for a variety of reasons. Could be professional competition, could be, you know, the hospital does not like that these procedures are going out of the institution. So they, for lack of a better term, decided that they will discredit the approach that a lot of us CLI operators are taking toward limb salvage. So to me, if I am able to salvage the limb with revascularization 1 year, 2 year, 3 years, 4 years, to me, in my opinion, and I think a lot of my peers, I don't want to speak for you, but a lot of my peers would agree that this is a success because we avoided a very bad outcome, which is an amputation that's been proven by evidence-based medicine to have a worse outcome than revascularization, surgical or endovascular, where, you know, you're being challenged by the dogma and the old guard that, you know what, no, amputation may be a better option for those patients. So that's why I struggled quite a bit because I know there's newer generation. I know that, Miguel, you, all the speakers here, you know, you lead the way trying to educate a lot of our peers and work with the young generation across all disciplines trying to change the mindset. It remains a challenge. I could not control the environment in a hospital setting. I know to a certain extent, Miguel, you felt a certain way. So because of that, we moved to the outpatient environment where we truly created the center around the patient's needs. I know this is kind of a cliche. Everybody uses that term. But let's face it. I mean, you cannot have, you know, a hospital needs to accommodate multiple needs, multiple areas, rightfully so. So a lot of institutions do not want, they don't have the expertise from physicians, from staff, nor the will to dedicate the resources necessary to salvage some of these limbs.
I couldn't agree more. I really advocate for the decentralization of care. It's almost like I feel that it should be a blockchain of CLTI care facilities, right? These decentralized systems.
So no
systems.
Centers of excellence.
I think they should be centers of excellence.
So everyone should have a center of excellence.
I believe that for reasonable and responsible care, there should be some guardrails created of what these facilities should be. Because, I mean, I've also been to Proctor. an OBL that was like a closet. And I don't think that that was safe patient care in any way, shape, or form. And then I've seen some of the facilities, you know, that we operate, and they're, you know, they're pretty well suited facilities with the right people, where there's research being done, where there's patient navigators, where there's people involved to create that longitudinal care that these patients need.
So there should be oversight.
I don't necessarily, I don't even know what the word oversight means. I would just say
it means that everybody agrees that there's a certain parameter in which you're going to operate, and then those parameters are enforced some way.
Is that, you know, if I may interject, that's an interesting point, because for the longest time, if you notice, a lot of the institutions and the hospitals say that there is no oversight, there is no standard of care. What's interesting is, well, what is the oversight? So far, we still did not define who constitutes a CLI operator. I mean, you probably get opinion among the four of us. You probably get different opinions, but we can, I mean, probably we're going to agree in the broad strokes. But so far, we don't have standardized way of defining a CLI operator. We all know not all cardiologists can be CLI operators, not all vascular surgeons can be CLI operators, and not all radiologists can be CLI operators, and not all podiatrists can be limb salvage specialists. But the reality is, on face value, they're all viewed equally. And to your point, a lot of these hospitals and institutions say, well, there's no oversight and there's no standard. Well, tell me, what is the oversight? And I think, Brett, you brought that point beautifully, and I said 2 years ago about, you know, when they talk about oversight. Well, I know OIS has took a very courageous step in the right direction that at least moves the needle in that direction. But you challenged that question when it was said, well, there is no oversight in the OBL, and you made the comment that you're not sure that you're seeing that in hospitals either.
Well, should that mean that there should be no? I think we have to come up with a, first of all, we have to unify as CLI operators and identify ourselves as such, and then some of the barriers and animosities can dissipate. And then after, you know, in that process, we have to kind of define, you know, what is the minimum that we need to be able to provide to be classified as a CLI physician? Because there has to be a minimum. There has to be a barrier under which, you know, there is not appropriate care, and above which is appropriate. And then there's going to be levels to every game, right? There's going to be, you know, the person that's operating at the 95th percentile, the person that's operating at 75th percentile, but we all agree that above some parameters, that's acceptable. So, you know, I understand that there's a hesitancy to provide the fences around, but if we want to be able to stave off criticism and say, you guys, and then, because they're going to be able to pick and choose, somebody doing something crazy, right? So when they do that, you say, okay, we have these standards and we applied these standards, and that person was outside those standards. So, you know, we as a community, have established the ground rules. That would be my opinion about that.
My biggest concern with creating more rules around access to these to these places is that we may, in the bigger scheme of things, hinder care to more patients, because you would essentially create a bottleneck, right? I mean, right now, there's not enough of us to take care of all the patients that's out there. There's not enough. There's sure as hell ain't enough vascular surgeons for even the society to be pompous about how we should be the ones taking care of this. That's the dumbest thing I've heard. But there's not even CLI operators, period, to take care of this problem. So there's a bigger problem right now about identification, about education, about, you know, patients not even getting a shot at multiple of these facilities, most of them actually hospitals, where they'll get a major amputation without even a vascular evaluation of any sort, duplex or angiography. Duplex, and certainly let alone even less angiography, but you know, that's a bigger problem, right? This is about, and if you create all these rules and regulations to get to the care, then I think it could just make things a little harder. Now, what I do think, to be constructive about where the conversation is going, is there is a need to substantiate the model of care. I wouldn't necessarily say, you know what, there's been threats and people talk and that other guy said this or said that or published it or published that. I don't care. I feel that's bullshit. I don't think our threat right now, you know, is a publicist. That's not the threat. The threat is not enough people understanding the value. That's the threat. The ignorance of the value of the decentralized outpatient model of care where these patients get better care. And I'm not saying that there isn't a great guy in a hospital that's doing great things. That's great. But I bet you that guy in an outpatient facility with all the right things around him could then choose to say, I am going to do these cases here, and then I'm going to migrate this patient that needs a popliteal bypass to the acute setting. And then I'm going to downgrade that patient back to the outpatient setting because that bypass had a retained valve and all it needs is a balloon angioplasty. And then in 2 years, it's going to have a restenosis of the anastomosis and that's going to need a balloon angioplasty. And you're going to do all this outside of the hospital. This is not about, you know, who's doing more or not. I'm just talking about there's a phenomenal way of caring for these sick patients. It's easier for them to get to us. We are faster to get to them. By all accounts, care is streamlined by an operator that is knowledgeable. And so how do we protect it? What do we do to be able to go out and protect it? And you don't need to agree with it. I'm just saying we need to protect it. And to that, I think I applaud those that in the past got together and built OEIS, for example. Because if we can't have an entity that speaks for us, how do you go about protecting it against any threats, right, of viability? So maybe let's segue with that into what OEIS is and what has OEIS brought to the table, because I also think that part of it is, you know, data, which I'd love Fadi to talk to. But Brett, you've been the president of OEIS. Would you mind speaking briefly about what OEIS is for anybody there that may not know what it is and the importance of what it means for the outpatient model?
Yes, happy to speak about that. So OEIS, which stands for the Outpatient Endovascular and Interventional Society, was formed in 2013 by a group of, I think there were 15 of us maybe, five from each of the major specialties that participate in primarily vascular care. So IR, cardiology, and vascular surgery. And we joke about it all the time when we talk about the history of OEIS, because most of the time spent in the Dallas airport where we had the meeting was figuring out what we're going to call ourselves. And that was like a 4-hour conversation. And we didn't do, admittedly, it was kind of OEIS is a mouthful when you say what it actually stands for. But what we were trying to do is be as broad as possible, but you know, find the sweet spot of what we're really trying to concentrate on. So that developed in 2013, and with 15 guys that really kind of came together to figure out a way to, you know, without sounding overly cliche, reach across the aisle and make sure we could all get together on the same page and advocate for the non-hospital side of service. At that point, many of us, at least on the IR side, had a facility open for, well, in my case, 7 years, and a couple of my colleagues even a few years before that. So the idea is kind of creating as best we could within a specified framework of equality across these three specialties, figure out how we as a new, brand new medical society could advocate for what we are doing, at least in large part in our practice. If you think about the three parent societies that oversee each of those specialties, it's acknowledged, this idea of non-hospital site of service is acknowledged as something that members of SVS and SIR and SCI and or ACC, it's part of individual practices, but it's not the priority 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5 really in the scheme of things. And so we felt like there was a need for a society that would advocate with that as the primary goal. Talk with all the decision makers in Washington, talk with payers, talk with CMS, talk with industry, talk with clinical research organizations. Hey, we're doing good work in this environment. We can participate in clinical research. We've been involved with multiple SFA stents studies, stem cell research, all kinds of stuff. And so it's a viable place for all of these things. And that's why OEIS was really formed, is to kind of create awareness, advocate. And within that context, there are certain pillars that we set up for kind of our guiding principles. And one of them happens to be what we were just talking about before, which is how do we create a, I'll say, accreditation / certification process and or peer review process that helps establish some of these guardrails. And so admittedly, we have struggled. We've had conversations with a couple accrediting bodies that we went through a lot of discussions and walked down the aisle with one particular entity. And at the end of the day, we couldn't quite finish it because it had to do with some ownership issues. But that is one thing that we need to work on. And, you know, to the point that was brought up before about standards, I think that it's a reasonable thing to consider. The problem is, on a practical standpoint, how do you go about it? And who sets those guidelines? Is it the individual societies? Is it somebody like OEIS, which is by design a multidisciplinary society? And is that the right thing to do? And the last thing I'll say about OEIS is that one of the things that we set out early to do is to create a registry to capture this data. Now it's well over 40,000 patients in the peripheral arterial module, and that is a very robust data set that we are using to create publications that are not only demonstrating or redemonstrating the safety of doing these complicated patients in an office-based environment, but also proving outcomes. And there's a phrase in the Bible that says the harvest is plenty, but the workers are few. And that, I think, exemplifies OEIS to the T, because we have a lot of work to do, and we need more people to be involved to do some of this heavy lifting. So I'll leave it at that and let other people comment.
Fadi, your two senses here about the importance of OEIS currently, and maybe more specifically on the data being mined. I know you're a huge fan.
Yeah, no, I absolutely. I mean, we all agree here that critical limb ischemia is one of the most challenging illnesses to study in a randomized controlled fashion, right? So it's just the level of complexity of some of those patients just excludes them from like 90% of the trials. And there has been publications done looking at some of the CLI trials, looking at what's the percentage of patients in the real world of CLI. And these are CLI trials. And in best case scenarios, these rates are up to 8 to 9%. So all of us here treat 90% of the patients. We really don't have randomized trials to address what we do. And this is not to say that there's no evidence. I'm just talking about the complexity. So with that said, you know, having a registry is, I think, not only nice, but it's fundamental to us understanding how do these patients behave? How can we treat them? And how do they fare after doing what we do? And the OAS registry is a gold mine for all of us. It doesn't matter outpatient, inpatient, but it's a gold mine for all of us to see how are we doing treating those patients. And like Brett alluded to, 40,000 patients, 250 centers, multidisciplinary, looking at multitude of patients, showing clearly, the papers. The paper is being worked on to be published, showing clearly that we are able to do this not only effectively but safely. And you know, Miguel, the challenging part is I don't see, and you know, you can call it criticism, you can call it a jab, but you don't see similar activity from a hospital setting, right? So. You know, there are attempts, you know, to track outcomes individually or through a couple of centers, but nothing as inclusive as the OAS registry. So, and by the way, it's open to outpatient, it's open to inpatient. It's not only, you know, it happens that the majority is outpatient centers, but it's available for anybody, even in a hospital setting. Very robust program. So I cannot emphasize, you know, how much we can learn from those things. Because, you know, let me give you a scenario. Let me give you an example. You and I take care of Mr. Smith, and Mr. Smith is you know, someone that presented with CLI in the right leg. We treated his SFA, we treated his tibials, required two interventions, three interventions, did well for a year, comes back with a wound on the left leg. And, you know, you're treating the left leg, he's doing good on the left leg, then 6 months later, he has another wound on the right leg. And, you know, you brought the example of dialysis patients. What's interesting is all of us here on this podcast would agree that we're doing a great job. We're salvaging this patient. He does not have a major amputation. He has his quality of life. If he's treating an outpatient environment, he's getting a procedure, 1 hour, 2 hours, whatever it is, the appropriate procedure, or for that matter, even surgery. But nonetheless, you're maintaining his independence for 1, 2, 3, 4 years. When this patient, if this patient ends up in a location or a center or with a physician that's not a CLI operator, the work that's being done by the CLI physician is viewed as failed procedures, which is very interesting because, and they say assessment and plan, the patient will require a major amputation below the knee. So that's considered treatment. But the procedures that was performed and maintained the limb for the last 3 or 4 years are considered failed intervention, right? So it goes to the point that was made earlier, like, you know, we need to establish what are our goals here. You know, I think that was a success. You think that was a success. In contrast to others who might think that, you know, this patient should have just had an amputation 3 years ago and moved on. And this sounds ridiculous. It might sound ridiculous to a lot of your listeners because I'm assuming whoever's going to listen to this is interested in limb salvage. But like you pointed out, it still happens every day. So something different needs to happen.
Yeah. But that relates to access to care. You know, obviously I've heard things like this happen in more kind of rural parts of Texas. And it sounds like I wouldn't believe that because, you know, I don't encounter that and I haven't encountered that in Houston, in San Antonio or in Austin. But I could see that happening somewhere in the Valley. And I think that's where the value of the independent physician comes in because those patients don't have access to maybe a structured environment where those places can hire CLI physicians or they're not accepted. CLI physicians don't want to go live there, but somebody that's independent might want to set up shop. So, but yeah, I definitely agree that, but I don't, you know, I guess, yeah. What is an endpoint? I think a positive endpoint, let's define that. What is a success in a Wi-Fi 4 wound, you know, at 1 month, 3 months, 6 months, 1 year?
I would even, you mentioned Wi-Fi, I would even go a little, I mean, even more basic than that. I would love to see that amputation-free survival, AFS, which a lot of trials look at. Just the fact that we're able to maintain the limb for the patient, even with toe amputation, with transmetatarsal amputation, whatever it is, but we're maintaining the limb for the patient. Because we have data. We have strong data. We have evidence to suggest that, look, when that happens, yes, it's not the greatest thing, but, you know, your mortality is not going to suddenly jump up to 50% and 60% within 12 months. You're still maintaining independence. We have clear evidence for that, but yet it's not being followed. So, you know, we're only asking, and by all, we, I mean, you know, the community of CLI physicians that are taking care of these patients. Like, let's look at our endpoint, because think about what the payers are saying. Think maybe that's a good segue to talk about what the insurance companies are saying, or even some physicians in hospitals. I mean, nobody is coming out and saying, well, you know, you treated this patient once, twice, or three times over the last year or 2 years. Maybe it's time for you to do a major amputation. Where in reality, you'd achieve the endpoint, which is amputation-free survival. They're still independent. A lot of them might still be working. A lot of them might be still be enjoying their life. Versus if you have a major amputation, if you survive that procedure or survive the comorbidities associated with it, you know, what's the percentage of you being able to walk again or be fit with a prosthesis or not losing the contralateral limb? So I think even like just keeping it simple,
let me ask you a question. Is an amputation ever the right choice?
For a CLI patient, yeah,
for a chronic CLI patient,
it should be the exception, not the rule.
But yeah, but what would be a scenario where you say, okay, this is the right choice?
There's multiple scenarios. I mean, if you ask me,
yeah, someone that's coming in septic.
Chronic. We're talking about more chronic stuff, yeah.
You have to look just because they're Rutherford class 6 or just because they have significant tissue loss, that's not without an angiogram, without seeing a CLI operator, that's not, in my opinion, it is not appropriate to say amputation from the beginning.
What about frailty, like somebody with a high frailty score, non-ambulatory, high, you know, 80, you know, older.
Because he loved, I mean, which is appropriate. I think when Miguel first started talking about it and how he teaches his residents and fellows about the frailty score, I think that's very important, you know, and it's something that's probably ignored by a lot of operators in terms of, you know, life expectancies, frailty, and nutritional status. So I would love for Miguel to talk about that.
Yeah, no, I don't think amputation is a wrong answer in very specific scenarios. But I think that we are biased by the fact that we do this on a daily basis. And so most other people that aren't biased by this, you know, a community surgeon or a community cardiologist, you know, or even general surgeons. I mean, there's areas in Texas that are not even served by specialists, where the trauma surgeon and the general surgeons are the ones that are evaluating these patients. And that's where the crux of the matter is, right? When it comes to us, it's going to be a very complicated conversation, because I would say probably 90% of the times we are going to believe that there's going to be a good option for that patient, and that that option is going to entail maybe some, you know, foot reconstruction and some, you know, minor amputations with some skin grafts, whatever that is, we'll get them out. And, you know, here's the kicker with that is I get called on a patient. I'll give you an example, but I get called to evaluate a patient that has an above the knee amputation on one end and has, you know, necrotic toes on the left. And the guy doesn't have any pain. Okay. Guy doesn't have any pain. He's very profoundly neuropathic. He's not infected. So he has dry gangrene of the forefoot. And I'm asked to do an evaluation, and he's got no option, and he's got severe heart failure. Okay. And I'll just say, I can't do anything. There's nothing I can do, not even an arterialization, nothing of what I could normally do. But this is stable. And the guy said, this happened when I was super sick in the ICU. And now he's not super sick. And so he has got 4-foot gangrene. And I asked the gentleman, what do you do? I said, well, I don't really do much. Well, my wife helps me out of bed. And I asked, well, how does that happen? He's like, well, I get the chair close and then I pivot on my leg and then I move. And how do you go to the toilet? Well, the same, right? I mean, my wife just kind of uses counter and I just pivot on this leg. In my note, despite having to come back and write it 5 times, was that he didn't need an amputation and that he had a functional extremity, despite the fact that some of the toes were dead. It wasn't making him sick. It came from an acute episode that was already passed. There wasn't any infection. I didn't have any ways to revascularize him. But this guy's 2 or 3 physical movements in his day were based on the pivot of his leg. And so I explained to the wife that if I did a major amputation of the other extremity, which, by the way, would be an above the knee, because he already has an above the knee, and we know what happens when you have a BK and an AK, they end up, you know, flexing the knee and contracting and all that horrible stuff, is that we would have to find a crane for her to be able to pick him out of the bed and put him in his chair, and then a crane to pick him out of the bed and then into the toilet, and all these occupational therapy nightmares. Or can you put betadine over the necrotic toes every morning and every night? And she's like, well, I'll choose the latter. Like, why would I cut the, like, it's, I say, well, you're not going to make the centerfold of any foot magazine, but, but it's fine. Right. And so I, you know, it just, these conversations demand a much in-depth understanding of what is the goal of care? What do they need from us? And it's not as easy as above or below the knee. It's not as easy as endo or not endo, open versus endo or atherectomy. These conversations are also mute. That's what I'm on a constant basis. So like disheartened by like the ongoing just chit chat on Twitter or the podiums. Like, what is all this bullshit? Why are we distracted by all this noise? When at the end of the problem is it's in every patient's needs have to be addressed. And you have to do that in the most unbiased possible way to the best of your abilities. And be that as an IR, as an IC, or as an AVS, to the best of your abilities. It's not about them only either. It's about what you can provide best for them for that moment, of course. Brett, I see you nodding. What's your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, this last little segment was all about, it basically highlights the complexity and the complications of this whole space from a couple standpoints. Number one is, as Fadi started with, is what defines success? And you know, there's so many components just of that. How do you define success? Is it technical success? You know, on table success? Is it, overall success in terms of amputation-free survival or whatever metric you might want to use? And it kind of moves into things like how we have defined success historically. Are we designing clinical trials of a very complicated patient population the right way? What are the trial endpoints? What are we defining? Is it limb salvage? Is it amputation-free survival? What are the metrics that we use when we're trying to conduct good science and try and find out what maybe is the best pathway? What's the right endpoint? And I think your example is perfect. It's so individualized that it's hard to apply one particular guideline or one particular standard to an individual patient. That's why guidelines exist. They don't exist because you have to follow this every step of the way each time. First of all, we don't really have those guidelines. If you look at the last published guideline, it talks about revascularization might be reasonable in these scenarios, but it really doesn't define what revascularization means. Is it a cutting balloon? Is it lithotripsy? Is it atherectomy? We just know that we need to be revascularized. So it's a very complicated scenario. I agree with you 100% that the general public looks at us, or even specialties outside of those that are involved in CLI care, looks at us, being the vascular specialists, as they look at us like we're distracted. And the catchy headlines and the sensational headlines seems to be what they react to when they come to that conclusion. Payers, even the same way. They say, well, even your own guidelines don't dictate how, what might be appropriate. And so we have so much work to do. You can't boil it down to one particular thing, whether it's reimbursement strategies or use of a particular device. It's way more complicated than that.
One interesting thing that's I think all of us on this podcast has experienced. I've yet to find a patient that comes to me. We all lose some battles, right? I mean, we all have patients that you do the best you can, and ultimately they end up with a major amputation. Otherwise, you're not a CLI operator. Not the best of days. But I've yet to see a patient come to me and say, "Doc, I wish you did not do this all of those years. I wish I would have just cut it off from the beginning and avoided all of this." But the reality is, the voice of the patient a lot of the times is kind of muted in these discussions. And if I'm gonna tout the horn of the CLI operators a little bit, we try to emphasize and amplify their voice as much as we can. In the example that Miguel just said right now, this is a perfect example. He took the time to kind of understand, how does this impact the patient life. I don't think patients' voices are heard very well within this conversation. I think, we're always viewed as biased in some way, shape, or form. And I think we're biased because we're involved with these patients. You're not meeting them for an hour or two. You know them, their families, their kids, who's taking care of them. You're involved in the care for a long time. Some of them, unfortunately, you don't see again because of a variety of reasons, but a lot of them, you're involved in their care. But, 99.9% of the time, every patient I took care of, even that they had to lose their limb, they're grateful, they were gracious, they were happy that they fought the fight. And a lot of the times they will console me because, I can tell I'm really upset about it because, I feel that I failed them. And that's something I think is missing from the conversation, highlighting the patient's needs and wants.
It's very true. How do we go about further facilitating the interaction amongst site of services care? Home health, inpatient rehab, skilled nursing facilities, and then our vascular care facilities. That's to me a huge conundrum. We were also discussing that with another group of people here in the podcast about how can you coordinate all these phases of care when not everybody's on the same incentive. It feels like we need to almost own the patient's longitudinal care, regardless of where they're at or what facility they may be at, and how to do that. I would like to just know from you guys what has worked for you guys in order to empower your outpatient facilities to be the care coordinators amongst different phases of care.
Well, let me tell you, Miguel, and depending on your point of view, you might consider my opinion extreme or not. Let's face it. In the hospital, if you get a UTI wire in the hospital is dead. If someone, God forbid, falls and breaks their hip, the hospital is dead. All of those things. Until amputation, without appropriate evaluation by a CLI physician or a vascular specialist, until amputation is a negative predictive point, meaning the hospital will be dinged if they do an amputation. And we've seen the latest publications up to 50-60% of patients get an amputation without appropriate evaluation, right? So until you're dinged for performing inappropriately a major amputation, I don't think things will change. You know, we all have these band-aid solutions. I know you give your cell phone to your patients. I know both of you give your cell phones to your patients. I know Brett does the same thing. I know I do the same thing, because you're sick of the patient going 2 hours away and suddenly you come into the office in the morning and someone tells you they had a major amputation because they went to the ER. They had a DVA the last week and they didn't know what to do with
it. Yep.
So, but that's a band-aid solution, right? So I think unless you change policy, reimbursement, and fine, you know, the patient needs an amputation, at least someone appropriately assessed the patient, had a conversation with them, and felt that was in the best interest of the patient, we're all going to be okay with that. But we all know that that's not happening. That's the challenge. The challenge is we don't have the expertise. We're not going to admit to the fact that we're not having the expertise. Mr. Smith is a heart failure patient. His EF is 30%. He's diabetic. He has renal failure. He's gonna lose this leg regardless. That's the line that a lot of us hear. He's losing this leg regardless this year, next year, after. Let's just do it. So, in my opinion, unless you know you make this a quality endpoint that hospitals and healthcare centers get dinged for, it's not gonna change.
That's a great point. I hadn't thought about that, but that's a really great point. That the amputation without assessment is not a ding on the system.
That'll throw alarms. And how close are we to that? I understand that there have been efforts in Washington to try to push this agenda.
Yeah, I'm not sure we're close to that, although I think that it's a lofty goal, and I do agree with it. I can't imagine that it is... Well, I was about to say, I can't imagine it's not a difficult thing, but everything is difficult in Washington these days. Yeah. So I was really, but the concept is great. The question is, how do you set up the system, then how do you implement it? And you got to get everybody in Washington to agree that it's a meaningful thing that is either going to help Medicare beneficiaries, and is it going to is it going to fly in the face of a very powerful lobbying group like the American Hospital Association? So everybody's going to have to sign off on that. And when it involves that kind of process, then you know, political lives are potentially at risk here. And we're talking about another political hot potato. So I suspect that that's in part why we're not really close to saying where there's legislation that says if you are a facility that is outside of the norm for hospital for pre-amputation evaluation by meeting these metrics, then you're going to get dinged. I think we're a long way from that, unfortunately, but I do like the concept. And going back to your original question, Miguel, there's a tremendous fragmentation of care as you've shared and as others have shared, and I think that is it's a problem resulting in the regional variation of care, but it also on a more local level. You know, I've had patients that go to a different facility that are part of a clinical trial and somehow get lost, and you know they just. They end up either with an amputation or they end up not following up. So I don't know what the most practical solution is. That is it worse in a rural environment or in an urban environment where there are, you know, 15 hospitals within 5 square miles, or in a rural environment where they just may go to the closest doc in the box or ER and kind of get lost that way. I don't really know how to get people into your concept of directing an individual patient's vascular care. I think that that's a big challenge as well.
I would love to understand of ways in which we can figure out better care modalities. But But the problem a lot of times comes to the lack of funding. A lot of these, I could think of hiring, a slur of APPs and nurse practitioners that could follow my patients all over the place, but that's expensive, right? And in a day and age where a lot of those codes have been contracted, then you're stuck with having to, in order to protect the viability of the model, is you can't really make it too big, right? It has to be incredibly nimble to be able to create a profit that sustains salaries for your team and yourself and gives yourself and your family some livelihood. But there has to be another way to access potential funds. And this is where this is kind of my stake here, that in whatever this, however many years I have still to kick, in however many years I will survive in this project, my intention is to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the centers of excellence should be decentralized and outpatient, and that there should be better continuum of care longitudinally. And that, yes, we need performance goals that are realistic, but that have to do with the patient-centric, right? Opioid levels, opioid utilization, pain-free days, amputation-free survival, ulcer-free survival, reintervention rates, whatever those may be.
I think something super interesting should be a comparison of intervention rates as related to amputation-free survival, comparing both in hospital setting and outside hospital setting. It's like, is that data out there? Like, if you look across the board, is there any difference? Because then you can really form an argument that at least there is absolutely no difference, or you might be better. And in regards to value and outcomes, and then you can build upon the other parts of kind of a more holistic system. But at the end of the day, I think there has to be a comparison with intervention rates and the end result, which should be amputation-free survival. Do you guys have any idea of that?
Well, amputation-free survival at least is a very bare minimum, right? I mean, because
do the bare minimum.
I told you Mr. Smith didn't get shit, and he's going to have his life for 2 years.
Yeah.
So the amputation-free survival is good.
Interventions with it and see if there's a relationship with it and see if there's any difference in the settings. I think that's a worthwhile...
Even if it wasn't, there'd be a bit better patient satisfaction and cost savings, period, which would be huge for the system. But I assure you it will. I assure you it will. Gentlemen, listen, I don't want to remove you from your families. It's Sunday. You gave me 1 hour, or you gave us 1 hour. And like always, we start somewhere, we take 20 tangents, and then we end up with a pretty good hour that I think a lot of our listeners are going to enjoy. Some will agree, some will disagree. Who cares? It's what the long format is all about. It's having conversations. It's putting it out there. It's talking about things, because it is the only way forward. I appreciate you guys. Brett, Fadi.
Thank you.
You guys rock. Thank you very much for doing this on a Sunday. God bless you. And we'll see you soon here on another show.
Two vascular surgeons walk into a bar and come out with a podcast. We are talking everything vascular and not. Welcome to the Life of Flow podcast.